For the last few years, we've utilized the third CD of this series to experiment with the development of new content for our work. And for this program, we chatted with three leaders from major U.S. cooperative groups for their take on the current and next generation of clinical trials in breast cancer. To begin, I met with Dr. Norman Walmark, director of the NSABP, who chatted with me at the group's recent 50th anniversary meeting. To begin, we discussed one of the newest trials of the group being done in partnership with the CIRG.
The BETH study is a reality. The BETH study opened very recently. It's a trial that will certainly complement the ALTO study. I think we really need to know what the addition of bevacizumab to Herceptin will do in that setting based on some very interesting preliminary preclinical work as well as early clinical findings.
And I guess you're referring to the fact that it looks like there's an upregulation of VEGF in these. Is it the patients with HER2-positive tumors in general or the ones who don't, who relapse?
Depending on which model you use, I think that there is an upregulation in general. You can certainly argue that point. How it'll play out in the adjuvant setting remains to be seen.
I guess the other issue that was a concern when bringing in bevacizumab and trastuzumab is the heart, of course. And from what I can tell, it seems like the main issue is the hypertension with Bev, or is it beyond that?
Yeah, no, I think it's both that were a concern. And as you know, this is a study that's done in partnership with BCIRG. And both the NSABP and BCIRG made the decision not to use an anthracycline template to test the combination of trastuzumab and bevacizumab, with one of the rationales being the potential toxicity of using the two agents on an anthracycline template. On the other hand, there are those, particularly in Europe, there is an independent group that is going to use an anthracycline template to test bevacizumab and Herceptin. So I think we will get a pretty good idea very rapidly as to whether that regimen is or is not tolerable.
And I guess in the United States or North America, it's just going to be TCH plus or minus Bev, is that?
Yes. Yes. Right now, that is certainly the case. Both the NSABP and BCIRG are offering TCH as the template.
And, you know, we've had John Mackey from the CIRG and Chuck Geyer from the NSABP, a lot of our education programs in the last year talking about this. And we've seen also in our patterns of care study a real movement away from anthracyclines in this situation off study. How do you see that? It's been kind of a big debate about whether people should hold on, node positive, et cetera. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have some deep-seated thoughts on that. I think that the retreat and abandonment of anthracyclines is proceeding with vigor, with some degree of mysticism. It's almost as if it's an autocatalytic phenomenon. And really, do we have the data to be secure? And the answer is we don't have the definitive data to abandon anthracyclines. I mean, the data for abandoning anthracyclines comes from three primary sources. The first source being meta-analyses, whereas the meta-analyses seem to indicate that in HER2-positive patients that anthracyclines have a benefit, whereas in HER2-negative they do not. But on the other hand, you know, those kinds of analyses are fraught with danger because we have certainly contributed. When you look at any review of meta-analyses, you see the two NSABP trials of B11 and B15, which were just about all but forgotten, that have suddenly taken on new life based on analyzing the HER2-new subset and showing that there's an effect of anthracyclines there.
What were those studies looking at? Were the randomization there?
Well, the B11 was regarded as the pure trial because we randomized patients who received LPAM5FU to the same LPAM5FU regimen to which 300 milligrams per meter squared cumulative dose of anthracycline was added. And there we saw a statistically significant interaction. But there's a danger there because you're utilizing a secondary endpoint and reporting it a posteriori. I mean, how many of these analyses have been done that have been negative that have not been reported? Just to give you an example, we went ahead and analyzed B23. Soon Paik went ahead and analyzed B23, which compared AC to CMF in receptor-negative patients, ERP PR-negative patients. And there was absolutely no interaction between HER2 and an effect of anthracycline. You don't see it on the curves or forest plots. And of course, then the argument is, well, you used the wrong marker to examine your data. You should have used topo 2A. Well, we did. And we saw no interaction with topo 2A.
Now, were there enough events there? I mean, because I guess, what, was it 20% or how many people were you?
Certainly there were. It was as good a study as B15. We don't make the same criticisms about B15 because it corroborated our bias.
Right.
So that gives you an example. Did we report the data from B23? No. So people don't use it in their meta-analysis. But this is just an example of the frailties involved.
What about in the HER2 positive situation? The argument's been made that trastuzumab sort of trumps over everything. TCH looks about the same as the anthracyclines. Why expose people to risk of leukemia and heart disease?
I think that's certainly a point that can't be dismissed. I think it's a compelling point, particularly for those individuals who are at risk. But the corollary of that is that in those individuals looking at BCR G006, co-amplify TOPO2 and HER2. And if you look at that, you can argue that only 8% will benefit from anthracyclines. There are some disquieting conclusions that come out of that, and that is that anthracyclines or trastuzumab contribute similarly, and that they're not additive, that they simply have an effect from either anthracyclines or trastuzumab in the co-amplified group. Well, Soon Paik looked at the B31 data. We can certainly look at the B31 data for TOPO2 amplification. We see in those individuals who either overexpress or amplify using a number of methodologies that we do not see the same phenomenon. We see that the co-amplified cohort benefits very significantly from the addition of trastuzumab to an anthracycline-based regimen.
But you didn't have a non-trastuzumab arm in that
study.
No,
but on the other hand, we're talking about the anthracycline arm of BCIRG006. All the curves were superimposed in the co-amplified cohort.
Right.
We don't see that. We see the curves almost wider in the TOPO2 amplified and overexpressed, either or, than we do in the non-co-amplified cohort. So I don't think we've heard the last of this. You know, certainly we have to publish that data, which we have not. We're just talking about it in general terms. But I'm concerned that we've made far-reaching conclusions without the definitive data. You know, certainly the trial from Jones, the TC versus AC, is very interesting. But that tells you nothing about the combination of an anthracycline with a taxane.
Thus the TIC-TAC study.
So is the TIC-TAC study in its current form going to be definitive?
And could you explain what that is? Because I just heard about that. You guys are getting involved with that, huh?
Yes, we'd like to. I mean, it's 6 cycles of TAC versus 6 cycles of TC that U.S. Oncology, Sarah Cannon are doing. But is that going to be a definitive trial? And the reason I say that is that it has a sample size of 2,000, and it has an 80% power to detect a 3.4% absolute difference in disease-free survival in favor of the anthracycline. So what if the difference is only 3% and the p-value is 0.08? What conclusions are we going to derive? So we and Steve Jones in U.S. Oncology would like to fold that trial into the tic-tac-toe trial, or the 3T trial, where we're comparing TAC to TC to TC-BEV, 3,900 patients.
How does TC-BEV become TOE, incidentally?
I think you'll have to ask that question. Steve Jones also calls it the tic-tac-doe trial because that's what it's going to take to fund and complete it. That's probably a better term for it. But at all events, it has a sample size of 3,900.
So the last arm is going to have BEV in it.
Last arm to determine if BEV on a non-anthracycline template can add benefit. And it will also increase the sample size for the pairwise comparison between TAC and TC to approximately 3,600, which would certainly give us a lot more power to really determine the value of an anthracycline or the lack thereof in a HER2-negative cohort.
That's a great idea. U.S. Oncology wants to do that too?
U.S. Oncology wants to do that in partnership with the NSABP, and Genentech is certainly very supportive of us moving forward with that trial.
It'll be interesting to see how the adjuvant Bev breast trials, how people react to that compared to how they reacted to NSABP's C08 and colon, where, bang, you know, 2,700 people in 2 years. Do you think we'll see that same kind of interest in the adjuvant breast Bev trials?
It remains to be seen. You know, we can predict all we want. We'll know soon enough.
I predict yes.
I think that the anthracycline question together with the Bev question is compelling.
But from a patient point of view, what I saw with C08 was patients and docs in practice wanted to take a shot at something hopefully not too toxic, certainly side effects-wise not too bad, that maybe for a patient who we know after getting any kind of chemo still has a residual risk of relapse, you know, it's something. I saw patients and docs very interested in that concept.
I'm interested in it. The people that we've discussed these trials are very interested in it. But, you know, again, there's no substitution for actually doing the trial and determining accrual.
Totally. That'll be interesting. Well, the other thing I want to ask you about in terms of HER2-positive disease is the letter first author, your colleague Soon Paik, and you're on the paper too. In the New England Journal on March 27th. Actually, we had had Soon at one of our think tanks about a month before this, and he presented again at that point what was, and I think a lot of the stuff in the New England Journal article was there on the issue of HER2 and the adjuvant trastuzumab studies. And when he presented this at our think tank, people were like just like fixed watching this data. I mean, it was fascinating and discussion was interesting. We actually took the presentation and put it up on the web so people could just see the data. It was fascinating. Can you kind of go through that story and the point that you were trying to make in this letter?
You're referring to the letter that was
yes,
in the New England
exactly.
Journal. Yeah, I mean, it has far-reaching ramifications that I think challenges some of the concepts that many people thought were inviolate. And in the some 500 or so patients in B31 that got in who on review were not IHC3+ and were not FISH positive using the standard criteria, looking at a forest plot, we see that there's very little difference in benefit between those who were HER2 low and those who were HER2 positive. Soon exhaustively analyzed this with a number of methodologies, with expression, with mRNA-based assays, and consistently, those individuals who were HER2 low on IHC or FISH were HER2 low as far as expression went as well. He went so far as to look at genes that were adjacent to HER2. And if HER2 was low, those genes that were adjacent were also low. So we're confident that this is not, you know, misinterpretation of morphology or misinterpretation of IHC or FISH analysis, that this is very real. So we submitted a concept to CTEP, which has been accepted pending requirements, of addressing the Herceptin question in this HER2 low subset, which accounts for 40% of the cohort. This is not a trivial cohort.
Now, what's interesting, HER2 low and HER2 negative?
Well, we don't want to put the IHC zeros.
So this is 1 and 2+?
Yes. Precisely.
And FISH negative.
As things stand now, and
right.
FISH negative.
So that's about 40%, and then another 40% IHC zero? Does that sound right?
We calculate that would, of the overall cohort that is traditionally not treated with Herceptin, it would be about 40% of that cohort, so-called high-risk node negatives and the HER2 low node positives. So we submitted the concept for TC versus TC Herceptin, the Jones regimen, if you will. And the requirement was to have a round-robin review of the slides, the IHC and FISH, by 3 objective blinded pathologists. And I'm not going to make any remarks about blind pathologists, but this is the prerequisite. And if there's concordance with the findings from the NSABP pathology soon, then this trial will go ahead as far as CTEP is concerned. So we're just in the process. It's not easy to find three pathologists who will do this. I mean, the pathologists wish to do this once we get involved with the institutions and the IP and what we have to deal with in today's era. This has proved to be a difficult task, but I think we have the three pathologists identified, and we're going to proceed with the round-robin review of the slides.
When are you projecting it's going to be completed?
I'm reluctant to do that because I've been wrong so often in my predictions, both for this specific endeavor as well as many others.
So hopefully it'll be soon. Not to play on words.
Yes,
there.
I think this is important because, I mean, this is really a radical new concept.
Totally. I mean,
and we've been disappointed that we really haven't had the level of enthusiasm from the entities that we had hoped we would have a level of enthusiasm to proceed with this because it's such an important concept.
Totally.
It's provocative. I mean, this is the kind of focus that you really need to explore. Otherwise, we're just doing more of the same.
Yeah, my enthusiasm. When I saw that presentation, I mean, everybody in the room was just, I mean, well, we had seen it before, but when it was all laid out together,
it
whoa.
Is very compelling.
It's scary.
And Soon has examined the data exhaustively. And yes, there was a debate with Mike Press and Soon at ASCO, but I think it has to go beyond the debate level, beyond the entertainment level. Because I think the individuals that really need to have this information are patients with breast cancer.
Just to clarify the numbers, because you said before 500, but the way I read it was about 174 patients with what you are calling HER2-negative disease.
Or HER2-low.
Because you have this table here, and I mean, it says disease progression and death, HER2-positive, HER2-negative. And under HER2-negative, you've got 20 recurrences out of 92 in HER2-negative and 7 with the trastuzumab. Deaths, 10 without trastuzumab, 1 with.
We were talking about the cohort of patient that falls into the 1+,
right.
2+,
right.
FISH negative category in its totality.
Right.
And in the forest plots, I'm giving you the numbers that I remember from the forest plots. And granted, my memory may not be pristine on this, but there were quite a few that were in there. It was not a trivial number, as I recall, was 4-something. Because, you know, when we looked at the numbers to say, oh, you know, it's going to be a small subset, but it wasn't. It was a significant proportion, enough to really develop an alternate hypothesis.
And I guess the answer or question that I've heard ever since this started last ASCO 2007 was, well, somebody called these people HER2 positive at some point. And now it's true that they look like they're HER2 negative. I'm not sure exactly what that statement means, but a lot of people say it.
Well, they say it to suggest that we have a biased group, that somewhere along the line, somebody thought that these people were positive. This is not an invalid criticism to say, well, Soon, of course, reviewed the data, you know, from other trials as well.
Right.
And comes up with the same conclusion.
And the other thing he makes in this lecture that we have up on the web is that you do see a correlation in ER between ER level and response to hormone therapy, as you might expect if you're targeting your target. But not just you guys, but also I think HERA as well as NCCTG have not seen a correlation with FISH
amplification.
Precisely.
So this is not just something that's unique to B31. There are other groups that seem to be reporting the same thing. And you can argue, yes, if you use fresh tissue, you wouldn't see it. But we're using the standard assays that are being used to make treatment decisions in women who have breast cancer. And if we see this phenomenon, I think that the onus is on us to either prove or disprove the hypothesis that we've generated, that HER2-low patients can benefit from Herceptin.
Any thoughts about what the possible mechanism might be? I've heard people speculate maybe some kind of immune mechanism that, you know, because I guess in the metastatic setting, it's felt that HER2, I'm not sure how well we really know this, HER2-low doesn't respond to trastuzumab.
There are many hypotheses, ADCC, there is a spate of publications that suggest that in micrometastasis and lymph nodes that you have a proportion of tumors that are HER2 positive that you may not have in the primary tumor. In the micrometastatic sites, you may have enrichment for HER2. Listen, if you demonstrate that this is a setting where HER2 is beneficial, there will be no shortage of theories to explain it.
And just to clarify, obviously a lot of people have questions. Suppose I have a patient who has HER2 2+ on IHC, FISH negative, 10 positive nodes, et cetera. Is there a role for trastuzumab outside a protocol setting?
It certainly would defy the accepted indications that we have now. I think everybody has to examine the data and make decisions based on it. I think that outside of a clinical trial, one should use Herceptin in the way that the indication suggests you ought to use Herceptin. If you don't do that, then you end up with chaos.
Yeah, I've heard that pretty much as a universal response. You mentioned the ALTO trial. That's the other major initiative right now in HER2-positive disease. And one of the things that they're looking at, obviously, that's so interesting there is the combination of two anti-HER2 agents, lapatinib and trastuzumab, both together, as well as sequentially. We saw some data from Joyce O'Shaughnessy at the last ASCO meeting about this concept. Where are we right now about our understanding about this as we move forward into the study?
I haven't heard any information to suggest that one ought to retreat from that. I think that the data support the rationale for proceeding with ALTO. I think there may be some dose modifications based on toxicity and the concentrations that you get in the AUCs and so on and so forth, but I don't think it refutes the question or the propriety of asking the question of combining lapatinib with Herceptin. I think it ought to go forward. It's a worthwhile study, just as I think the Beth trial, which I think would be, an excellent complement with an E, nothing's free today, to the ALTO trial. And I think both of these trials in their totality would certainly extend our knowledge of HER2-positive disease pretty significantly.
Now, another study I want to ask you about, and I don't think it's up yet, is the study looking at the question that a lot of people have about patients who have residual tumor after neoadjuvant anthracycline taxane therapy. What number is that going to be?
B45.
You have a number for that?
We do have a number. It's B45 number, yes. So this is a setting where those individuals who receive preoperative therapy who do not achieve a PCR either in the primary breast or in the axillary nodes. That's how we're defining a non-PCR in this trial. And they will be randomized to a year of sunitinib or to a placebo. To determine in this high-risk population, because we know that those individuals who don't achieve a PCR are at high risk, and you can fine-tune that risk either based on doing a genetic profile the way Soon Paik has done or on the number of residual positive nodes, which is also a very good determinant as to their rate of failure. So this is a high-risk group. And you would think that this would be a very exciting setting to determine the value of a biological. And yet it's taken us the better part of 5 years to bring this trial to fruition, which I think is going to start in September. It's at the point where it's with the CIRB. And we're hoping that we're going to get a September start on this trial, which, again, is not a trial with an enormous sample size. I think there are about 2,000 patients in with a hazard rate of 0.75 in favor of sunitinib. So this is a doable trial, and why we haven't had people banging on our door before sunitinib is a mystery to us, because this is a very interesting biologic setting. It's a unique opportunity to test a biologic.
And it's a situation that I think docs have a lot of interest in. It's funny because just this morning I was talking to a doc in practice who's presenting cases next week at our Meet the Professor session. And straightforward, just what you're looking at, a patient who's got significant residual disease after therapy, who wanted to present her to see what people would do. And I said, have you heard about this trial coming up? Because he puts patients on studies looking at sunitinib. And he said, no, I didn't know about it. I said, well, would you put her on? He said, absolutely. So I think there'd be a lot of interest in this study. What do we know about the issue of these particular patients in terms of their likelihood looking at translational things that predict whether or not Sutent might help?
We don't have an algorithm to say that we think that it's going to work definitively in this particular subset, but not in this one. So I think we're going to collect the information. Certainly, one of the prerequisites is going to be to have a robust tissue collection, which, of course, is difficult in any setting. It will probably be more difficult in this one, but we're certainly going to make the effort.